So we're just starting with chapter 5.
The start of chapter 5 in Genesis, we see another reference to possibly a different historical document that Moses would have referred to in putting the book together. It says, this is the book of the genealogy of Adam. Again, where it says genealogy, that's that Hebrew word toldoth, which can mean genealogy or history, or sometimes it's translated generations. So it's not vital important to pin down exactly what it means, but again, it seems to be referencing another document, which makes sense. So he's again reminding us of God's creation of mankind. You know, in the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female, once again, both in God's image and likeness. Blessed them and called them mankind in the day that they were created. And nobody here is using the old King James in class, are they? Okay, you are. What does your version say where it says he called them mankind? What does it say? Okay, that's what I was getting at. The name Adam is Hebrew for mankind. It's generally translated. So it's worth noting that somebody brought something to my attention when I was an Ambassador College student that I'd never thought of. And it doesn't hold water doctrinally, but it's kind of interesting because they pointed out the common custom we have in Western society for when two people get married for the woman to take the husband's name. They said, well, Adam and Eve got married and God called their name Adam. So the woman takes the man's name. As I said, that doesn't really hold when you say, oh, the Hebrew, actually the New King James is a more accurate translation. But it's worth being aware that that is there and might be one of the reasons it's been that way. It is, yeah, the Hebrew word is Adam, yeah, or Adam. And I believe it means red because it was made from red clay or mud. So it's worth knowing the underlying words have various meanings. But we move on from there. It says, Adam lived 130 years, begat a son in his own image and likeness, named him Seth. I pointed out earlier, this doesn't necessarily mean that Seth was Adam's third-born son, but he's named because he's the ancestor of Noah, and therefore of all of us. And Adam and Eve apparently had lots of sons and daughters, because it says, you know, in verse 4, after he begat Seth, days of Adam were 800 years, he had sons and daughters, unnamed because we don't know them and we don't know their descendants. One day, we'll get to meet them. They'll be raised in the second resurrection along with all those other people. But for now, we don't have to know. And I commented in the previous class, when it says his image and likeness, you know, we could speculate, and it still is that, but perhaps if Adam and Eve were having children of different, you know, look, different appearances, we would say different ethnicities. You know, Seth might have stood out because, hey, this one looks like you, Adam. But, you know, as I said, this is my personal speculation. I will say, though, it goes on from there through most of the chapter with the genealogy. And I've got a comment. Genealogies provide a good chronological framework. Sometimes they're good for showing specifically how God fulfills his promises, but they make pretty dull reading. And so I'm not planning on reading all of these. It's worth noting, though, that as we go through this, it's often an inclination to think of each of these sons' names, and of course we don't have the daughters' names, but to think, well, this is the firstborn. He lived so many years, he had this person, and then sons and daughters. But it's not necessarily saying that each person named is the firstborn. The one that's named is the one that's in the genealogy down to Noah. And that's why we need to know them, because we're descended from these people and not from the others. As we say in verse 29, it brings us down to Noah, which we'll comment on in a moment. A couple of things we'll back up, but it's worth taking a pause just to think about before we proceed. If you look at how long these people lived, they lived a long time compared to us, didn't they? Hundreds of years. How? Why did they live so long? Anybody know? Emily? Okay, there a canopy consisting of...
It was... I always thought of it like a film where like pollutants didn't come in. And okay. Things like grew to larger sizes and the air was cleaner. I forgot the term.
Yeah, it's pretty common theory. And I've heard some people describe it as even a water canopy. Especially in the creation account, says he separated the waters above from the waters below. So that's That's not an uncommon theory. Sky?
Maybe that it took them a while to start dying younger, so as time went on, they died younger.
But maybe you're getting at the idea that maybe genetic and physiological deterioration didn't set in until later. A lot of people think that. Andrew, did you have one?
It was definitely a more pure Earth, not polluted in any way.
Yeah. Julia?
I was trying to find the scripture, but I don't know the exact one. But it may have been God's original intent for us to live that long, because it says in the Bible somewhere where God told us, I will now limit your years to 120.
Yeah, we're going to come to that probably should be today. And there's different understandings of what exactly that's meant, was meant by that. But that is one of them, that you know, God made a change. It seems that way. And I wanted to entertain different thoughts, because the fact is we can't prove absolutely any one of them. But it does. We know, if we believe the Bible, they lived a lot longer. And then after the flood, the lifespans decreased dramatically. So it makes sense that water canopy is one that's like, we don't have a written record or photos of it, or, but you know, that could have fit together to make the atmosphere more pure. People speculate that it might have shielded us, mankind, more from cosmic radiation and such. Perhaps they had a different diet, perhaps, you know, the bodies hadn't degraded as much. I put in my notes here, to be certain, we have to wait for God to explain it, and then we'll know for sure. So you can be convinced of one idea, and someone else can be convinced of another one, and that's okay. I think it's important we believe what it says, and God didn't see fit to tell us, well, this is why they lived 800 years, and you barely make it to 80. But, you know, so something changed. Let's back up and see a couple of things we note of. In verse 21, there's a fellow named Enoch who didn't live all that long. He lived 65 years and begot Methuselah. After Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years. Everyone else is in the 7, 8, 900 years. He gets to 300 years. And then in verse 24 says, and he was not, for God took him. I should point out, walked with God is a common phrase meaning having a close relationship, regular communion. So the implication isn't just that he and God got together and went down the walking trail every morning for their health. It means that his way of life was in communion with God. You know, something we hope we all walk with God in that way. What's the common interpretation of what happened to him? Emily, you? Okay, Charlie?
Most people believe that Enoch was taken to heaven.
Okay, that's the common interpretation. Most Christians. And if you believe that upon death you go to heaven or hell, that would be what the conclusion you would come to.
God kept him alive as long as God wanted him alive, so God put him to, I guess you could say, sleep. Same way when Moses went up to the mountain, God let him die there.
Mm-hmm. That's
one of the, I've heard that's one of the explanations.
I've heard that too. Yes, Sky?
They say that God took him somewhere else.
We should bring in Hebrews 11:5 makes reference to this. Hebrews 11, we call the faith chapter, references many people of faith from the Old Testament, and Enoch is mentioned there. And there, the word that's used in Greek is, maybe I'll write it down, even though I'm guessing, well, Mr. Myers will get to this, but a lot of times when he gets to Hebrews, he's rushing because he's running out of time. The Greek used there is metitithemi, M-E-T-I-T-I-T-H-E-M-I. He metitithemied Enoch, which could be translated as translated, or exchanged, or removed, or changed sides. Kind of like a pro football team might make a trade for a player. So, did God traded Enoch, you know, for a draft pick? No, not necessarily for a draft pick, but that implies moving him, not necessarily taking him to heaven. Andrew?
I have another answer to what you were asking before. Mm-hmm. Possibly he lived 65 years just as a regular human being, not really thinking about God. And then because it says, and had sons and daughters, I think he got to be allowed to do that.
Right, yeah.
So
he does this. And it does clearly say that he lived 365 years total.
All the days of Enoch were 365 years. So at some point, it does say, if he only lived that long, at some point he died. He's not in heaven. You know, God might have removed him from a dangerous situation, but not so he could still continue. And by the way, there are some, you can find some religions that will say he's still alive somewhere today. And they'll put him with Elijah. The same similar questions come up. Elijah is taken up in a chariot of fire, and Elisha is blown away. And then people say, well, God just took him straight to heaven. No, the rest of the Bible doesn't support going to heaven, so we have to come up with a different explanation, because here it doesn't say he went to heaven. So the idea of saving him from a dangerous situation is a fair possibility, but at some point his life ended. An old minister in the church brought up something that I'd never heard of before earlier this year, and it's something that our church speculated on as far as to even put it in print, that we covered earlier, the Lamech that had two wives, and said, you know, if Enoch got in trouble for killing a man, you know, I killed a man, you can match the genealogies, and it's possible that the man he killed was Enoch. You know, there's no reason to think it was, though. You'd think it would have said, but we used to speculate perhaps that's what happened. Some way or another, his life came to an end, but the bottom line is we don't think God took him to heaven, because that's contradictory to everything else, not everything else in the Bible, but all the teaching about heaven and what happens when we die. It says in verse 23, all the days of Enoch were 365. So if that's all of his days, generally it's interpreted to mean he's done after that. Matt.
I just add to your point, which you're saying, continuing on in Hebrews 11 when you get to 13.
Oh, uh-huh.
After listing all people like Enoch, says, all these died in faith, not having received their promises. And
thank you. I need to remember to say that when I quote from Hebrews. Yeah, because when it says all these, Enoch was one of the all these who died in faith. Charlie, did you have something, or have I already mentioned it?
Hebrews 11, verse 5, it says he was taken away. So it's possible, similar to Elijah was taken up in the chariot, but not to heaven. He was taken to a different area of the earth. So I think maybe God just took
Enoch
to a different area, and then he died. Not a natural death, because it says he did not see death, meaning natural death, I think. God must have just...
Perhaps he didn't see death at the particular time that God took him, but eventually he saw death. Exactly. So that's what we... This is another case of the Bible not telling us all that we would want to know, leaving us curious. And again, remember something we're going to see in the book of Isaiah later today, where God doesn't let everybody understand his word. And it's made so most of the people don't understand until through his Holy Spirit he grants understanding. This might be something he left vague purposely, thinking, okay, people will get a little off track because, you know, I don't need them to all understand just yet. I'll comment, Methuselah comes up. He's covered in verses 25 to 27. He lived the longest human life on record, 969 years. Calculations show that he died the same year as the flood. Which I've always wondered, does that mean he died in the flood, or that God allowed him to die just before the flood came? You know, other people might have lived longer and just they're not in this genealogy. But it's not, that's not something we need to know. We get down to verse 29, though, and we come to Noah. It says, he called his name Noah, saying, this one will comfort us. Noah is from the Hebrew Nacham, N-A-C-H-A-M, which does mean comfort or rest. So it makes you wonder if God inspired that name, thinking, okay, I'm going to work through this one, or lucky guess. Probably not that. And Noah, in verse 32, was 500 years old. Noah begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth. I have heard speculation that those three were triplets, but there is no scriptural support of that. Interestingly, Shem, they're usually listed that way, Shem, Ham, Japheth, although Japheth was the oldest. Later on, he's mentioned as the elder, and it's thought that perhaps Shem is often given the preeminence because he would be the ancestor of Jesus Christ, although, again, Scripture doesn't specifically say that either. You know, some scholars speculate, you know, Noah didn't have any children before he was 500 years old. Well, it does say he lived 500 years and begot them. There's speculation of, does it mean that's when, or referring to when God is going to talk to Noah about building the ark. Because we'll see in chapter 6, verse 3, the Lord said, "My spirit shall not strive with man forever. Indeed, for he is indeed flesh. His days shall be 120. That's the scripture Julia was referencing earlier. So here God seems to be giving man 120 years till the destruction comes, or some have speculated this is when God says, look, I got to cut down how long they're living. The main problem with that is after the flood, we see several people living well beyond 120, and eventually it gets to where almost no one does. Chapter 7, verse 11 makes the point that the flood came when Noah was 600 years old. So we can put that, he was 500, had Shem, Ham, and Japheth. You know, the flood comes when he's 600. And there's another reference, the 120. So we put these together, say he was probably building the ark for about 100 years, maybe 120. And since we don't have to know exactly and it's not specific, I tend to say he was building it about 100 years. And that's close enough for me. Emily, you had your hand up.
I was just wondering, it says that Enoch walked with God. How did people back then stay close to God? Like, so we do it through prayer and Bible study and all of that. But aside from prayer, I mean, they didn't really have a Bible to study.
Well, we don't know exactly what they had. God had been in communication with them to some degree. And apparently, I speculate, maybe met with Adam and Eve a number of times. I'm guessing they had some type of instruction of God's way, but I don't know what it was exactly. Yes, Stephen?
Sacrifices and offerings were a part of the worship system that was known at that time, and so that would have been their primary way of approaching God and keeping a relationship with him.
And we don't know but what God might have come down and talked to Enoch. Again, we're covering a lot of time with a few words, so we're left wondering. But saying he walked with God, we could speculate perhaps he did literally. I was saying it doesn't mean that he necessarily did literally, but we can't rule that out. And I'd love it if God was my jogging partner in the mornings. I went out. No, I didn't run. Yesterday morning was jogging day. But, of course, it's hard to talk much when you're running. But walking, you can carry on a conversation. I'm getting off track here. Let's move on with chapter 6. It came to pass when men, of course, so we've introduced Noah and his children, and we know he's got a big part to play, but we're going to back up and talk about some other things for a few verses. Men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them. Which is nice to know. So far they keep mentioning sons, or the names of sons, but all these people, they lived so many years, begot someone, and then had sons and daughters. The sons of God saw that the daughters of men, they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. Again, for sake of time, I'll summarize this. There are many who have, I believe, mistakenly said that this is referring to angels mating with humans. And then they refer to later what's called giants being the result. We don't believe that's true. Let me give you a list of three reasons that we use to say, no, the Bible seems to indicate against this. One is Jesus Christ himself taught that angels are what we could call asexual. He said they're not married or given in marriage. A couple of scriptural references in the Synoptics, Matthew 22, 30, and also Luke 20, verses 34 to 38. That's the case where they were trying to trick Jesus up by having this kind of ridiculous scenario of this woman who was married to seven brothers, one after the other, and they didn't have any children. So they said, well, if there's a resurrection, whose wife is she going to be? And Jesus said, you don't even know enough to ask the right question, which he didn't say it in those words, but he said, in the resurrection, they're like angels. They're not married or given in marriage, which we don't interpret to mean we're going to be like angels, but we're going to, that sex, is, sex physically isn't something that pertains to spirit beings. Sure. Genderless, yeah. Well, I wanted to say sex, gender, we refer to the cultural things as well, at least in modern day. Okay. Another point to disprove this is that there are places in the Bible where the term sons of God does mean human beings. I'll give you one in Luke 3, verse 38, if I can read my writing. Luke 3, verse 38, the genealogy of Jesus Christ is given from Jesus Christ all the way back to Adam. And the way it's worded is, Christ, the son of Joseph, Joseph, the son of, blah, blah, the son of. And it gets to Adam. who was the Son of God. And it was the Son of God in the sense that God created Adam out of the dust of the ground, but not through procreation the way we, you know, create new human beings. Next to that, I'm not going to give the read it, but Psalm 82 and verse 6. Psalm 82, 6. So it's not incorrect to say that human beings are all sons of God in the fact that we're the creation of God. Now, when we're baptized and receive the Holy Spirit, we become a conceived or begotten son of God, which is a different step. Okay, a third reason is not from the Bible, but one that looks to science, and that is throughout all creation, we see that biological law, I'm trying to talk too fast, or we could say biology allows only kind to produce after kind. In other words, you know, a cow can't go mate with an ostrich and have a hybrid baby, which it's ridiculous. Don't even envision that. But angels can't mate with humans. They're not the same, you know, and can't create some half-breed. There's no exceptions. You can have different sort of, like I know, like a lion and a tiger could mate and create, what is it, a liger or whatever. But you can't have a lion and a coyote. You know, you can't go that far apart. So if it doesn't mean angels mating with humans, what does it mean? It doesn't tell us. There's some speculation. One I referenced earlier when I was talking about the line of Cain that was listed after he was, you know, sent into wandering. Some have said that maybe the descendants of Seth are those called sons of God, and the descendants of Cain were the daughters of men. And that's a serious speculation, but my biggest hesitation there is, well, Adam and Eve had a lot of other children. Which were they? And that speculation doesn't address that. A common one, and this is one we used to rely on heavily in the church and we've backed away from somewhat, was that it refers to people taking wives of all whom they chose, which it specifically says, towards the end of verse 2, they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose, and some would say this is referring to interracial marriage. Oh, you're marrying someone that you shouldn't. It's of a different background. And we taught that a lot more in the 50s and 60s in the context of the United States culture where that was frowned on. Well, it's still somewhat frowned on, but in a different way. But knowing, as we'll see with the story of the Tower of Babel, God did want the different groups to separate. So it still could have reference of God said, look, I made all these different types of people come out of Adam and Eve because I wanted to establish different races, so stop mixing them up. And so that leaves speculation for that being a valid explanation still possible. Another possibility is just, you know, as it says in verse 1, men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born. It could just be referring back to that, saying, yeah, they chose whoever they wanted and they were making babies and lots of them. And it's possible it's really just as simple as that. After all this uproar, is it angels and men? Is it this or that? Could just be saying, look, they married whoever they wanted. And you could say maybe multiple partners and, you know, whoever they wanted, one after another, all of them at once. And boy, they were having lots of kids. You know, I don't think we have to know for certain. It's just good to know that it wasn't the most bizarre one of these angel human half-breeds. Which brings up the question then in verse 3. The Lord said, my spirit will not strive with man forever. He's flesh, his days will be 120. Again, that seems to be reference to when he's going to send the flood and wipe out the planet. I would say it refers to limiting the lifespan, but if so, that it takes place considerably later. We know, like, Abraham would live to be 175. I think his son Isaac, 180, and Jacob lived well past 120. I don't know anybody that lives that long today. So man's lifespan did get down there eventually. But anyways, verse 4, there were giants on the earth in those days. And also afterward, when the sons of God came to the daughters of men, they bore the children to them. Those were mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Oh, well, forget all that you said, Dunkel. This is, well, obviously angels breeding with humans. It's making these giants. Well, the word giants is translated from the Hebrew Nephilim, which can mean giants, but it also can mean fallen ones. which people, oh, fallen angels. No, it can mean apostate, fallen from the truth, which is a more common meaning than people want to give it credit for. You know, it refers to being depraved and cut off from God, perhaps more than anyone's size. So they're marrying whoever they want, having all these children, and they're not being taught God's way. They're apostatized. They're fallen away from God. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't giants. You know, matter of fact, we know David bumped into Goliath, who was 9 feet tall, and Goliath had family that were killed. So I don't want to say, well, there's no such thing as giants in the Bible. There were, but this isn't necessarily referring to that. Although there were mighty men of, yeah, who were of old, men of renown. Ah, okay. In any event, as I said, I don't want to make it confusing, but I want us to realize, okay, you might have just heard one explanation for a verse before when several could apply. And you might have heard one that we can disprove. So we want to rightly weigh God's word and rightly divide it and put it together to not accept the falsehoods, but you know, also not pigeonhole ourselves in a narrow understanding that also might not be true. Okay, verse 5. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth. Every intent of the hearts or of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry he'd made man on earth, and he grieved in his heart. Again, this shows that God has feelings and emotions. I think it's worth reminding us, and we have them, the feelings and emotions, because we're made in God's image and likeness. It's not an accident. God didn't make us to be Mr. Spock or Mr. Data or Pinocchio wishing we could be a real boy. I'm trying to think if I can hit a pop culture reference that'll cover everybody. You know, he made us like him, and he was grieved. It bothered him. He wasn't just angry. He was saddened. Okay, this shows also how completely immoral people had gotten. Most thinking was evil, and God decided it was beyond repair at this point. I made a couple of scriptural references here. Matthew 15 and verse 19. Matthew 15, 19 is where Christ discussed and said, out of the heart, which is really referring to our mind, proceed evil thoughts. That was Matthew 15, 19. Also, Proverbs 23, verse 7. Proverbs 23, 7 says, as he thinks in his heart, so he is. And that's, you know, okay, he's talking about the thoughts of men's hearts were evil continually, and of course that led to the wickedness. I was looking for the meaning of something else. The Lord said, I'll destroy man whom I've created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing, birds of the air. I'm sorry I made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. The word there for grace is chen. You could say chin, but it's that sound. Am I, those of you who have lived in Israel, am I getting anywhere close? Oh, okay, I'll take that. And it means literally favor, kindness, giving a blessing. It does, that blessing can and does include forgiveness. And I want to make the point because this is the Hebrew. The Greek word is charis, which I can't remember if I've mentioned that in general epistles. We've often in the past defined grace as free, unmerited pardon, forgiveness of sin. And it does include that, but it can be much more. It can be given something that you didn't earn or deserve. Why am I making such a big deal of it right now? Partly because this is the first place the word appears in the Bible. And it's a lot of the Bible is about grace, so I thought, hey, let's notice here. Noah, not Moses yet, found grace. Doesn't say he earned it. He must have been a pretty good guy, but also God's going to give him much more. So then we move on. Noah, verse 9, this is the genealogy of Noah. Again, the toldoth of Noah. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God. Enoch walked with God. Noah walked with God. Same understanding of meaning a relationship and getting along. This is not saying that Noah was without any fault. You know, perfect in his generations doesn't mean perfect as in he never committed any sin. And I can say that with certainty why. How do I know for sure that, well, there's a couple reasons now I think about it. Yes.
The only one to come on this earth and not sin is Jesus Christ.
Okay, Jesus Christ is the only one without sin. Memory scripture, Romans 3:23, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Not to mention later after the flood, we'll see an account of one of Noah's sins. Of course, that was later. You could say, well, he was perfect till then. Probably not, though. But he was sincere, and he was striving to live a godly lifestyle. He was walking with God, which I hope all of us, we're striving to walk with God. But that doesn't mean that we're all without sin, just we want to be. We're trying to be. Some have said that perfect in his generations would refer to having no interracial marriage in his ancestry. Tie this to the idea of interpreting men took the wives of all whom they chose. When some interpret that to mean interracial marriage, they said, well, this proves Noah didn't have that. We can't disprove that interpretation, but there's no reason to think it's higher and more valid than others. Emily?
Wouldn't his sons all have to be different races in order for there to be different races now, pretty much?
Okay, most people think their wives were of different races. That's a common interpretation. But I was going to make the point, it says that Noah was perfect in his generations. That would make his sons perfect if it meant no interracial marriage, except for maybe they married people of different, I think what it means is he stood out in his time and his generation. The word does have that meaning. And I lean towards that. He, out of all those people living on the world whose thoughts of their heart were wicked and evil continually, Noah wasn't like that. We've got one of my son Connor's children's books, and it shows these people being mean to each other, but Noah has a smile and he's helping people. Okay, if that helps you think of Noah being perfect in his generations, he's different than others, that's worth it. He walked with God. And he had these three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Verse 11, the earth was corrupt before God. The earth was filled with violence. Again, you might connect this to Matthew 24, verse 38. Matthew 24, 38, as part of the Olivet prophecy. Remember, the disciples asked Christ, what's going to be the sign of your coming? When will these things happen? Because he mentioned the buildings being overthrown. One of the things is he said the times before his return would be like in the days of Noah. And we think before Christ returns, it's going to get really bad. Well, that's how bad it was in the days of Noah. And then we look around us today and say, were the days of Noah like this? Maybe, and maybe even worse. When I think of when it gets to be as bad as the days of Noah, does that mean we're about ready for the end? And it frightens me a little, or at least it sobers me, because I think, boy, how much worse can it get? Of course, they said that back in the 50s and 60s, and it's gotten worse. I heard it in the 70s and 80s, and it's gotten worse. So I don't want to say how much worse can it get, because I'm afraid I'll see how much worse it can get. But we know we're coming to a similar conclusion. Evil continually, the world filled with it, and God saying that's enough. Again, and there's a little bit of a repetition of what was said before in verse 12. God looked on the earth, indeed it was corrupt. All flesh had corrupted their ways on the earth. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I'll destroy them with a flood. Well, again, if you haven't heard the Bill Cosby routine, it's worth listening to. And he says, God tells him, make this ark. What do you want me to do this weird stuff for? I'm going to destroy the world. Oh, okay, God tells Noah, I'm going to destroy the world. And here it says he tells him that first, and then he starts telling them to get ready. Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood. It doesn't mean planting gophers in the ground and trees grow up made of gophers. We don't know exactly what gopher wood was, but scholars believe probably cypress or cedar. So pretty good wood for building with, I think. And the Hebrew word that's translated ark, some places is translated palace. And the ark wasn't a palace, but it's a big dwelling. It's not necessarily a word for ship, but I'm not sure when ships came on the scene. The length of the ark will be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, its height 30. And studies have shown that ratio is a good ratio. And keep in mind, the ark was not designed for navigation, meaning to be able to steer and go where you want. It was made to float and bob around like a cork and stay upright. And that ratio is good for that. How big was it? It's worth noting, first of all, we say, what's a cubit? Bill Cosby routine says, okay, do all this. Okay, right. What's a cubit? Anyone, what is a cubit? Okay, Andrew's showing me. They didn't have ruling systems, so it's a measure from your elbow up to here. Okay. Ah, her cubit's not the same size as mine. Andrew? His cubit's bigger than mine. So there's some speculation. Did they come up with a standard measure, or was it just however tall Noah was? I don't know how tall Noah was. Some say that the cubit was about 22 inches. If so, then the ark was 547 feet long by 91 feet wide and 47 feet tall. This is what they call the long cubit. A shorter estimate is 18 inches, a foot and a half. And I like this one because the numbers come out more even. Because it would have been 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet tall. That's good, but you know, that's just translating it into English units of measure. If we wanted to do meters, you know, round numbers wouldn't necessarily come out. And the important thing is the ratios were even, and it was big. Anyone seen the Ark about an hour south of here in Kentucky? And I'm not sure if it's the exact size, if they used a big cubit or a smaller cubit, but it's big. You know, I went down to see it during the feast last year, and it's a pretty impressive building. And to think, you know, we don't know, as far as I know, Noah didn't have any Black and Decker power tools, so he's working with hand-powered tools, maybe for about 100 years. With who helping him? No, we sort of guess maybe Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Did he hire workers? Possibly. Lots we don't know. I will make a reference to Hebrews 11, verse 7. Once again, the faith chapter. Because it says, by faith, Noah built the ark. He had no physical evidence that there's going to be a flood here. And remember, there's some speculation that there was no such thing as rain before this time. And when that reference back earlier in Genesis, some people say, hey, there's no such thing as rain, so why would you think there's going to be a flood? But in faith, he obeyed God and built this ark. And built it to these specifications. It goes on in verse 16, you'll make a window for the ark. The Bible doesn't tell us exactly where the window was positioned. Finish it to a cubit from above. So maybe a cubit from the top, not sure. Set a door in the side of it. Make it with lower, second, and third decks. So three decks in the ark. Behold, I myself am bringing flood waters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh, which is the breath of life. Everything on the earth shall die. Whew. But I'll establish my covenant with you. You'll go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. So it's very specific who's going to stay alive. Oh, but that's an awful big boat for eight people. But he's not done yet, of course. And this is the story we all remember from when we're kids. And of every living thing of all flesh, you'll bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female, which is good because if you brought in two males, that's not going to help preserve the species. Of the birds after their kind, the animals after their kind, of every creeping thing of the earth after its kind, two of every kind will come to keep them alive. And take for yourself all food that is eaten. Doesn't describe what kind of food, but gather it to yourself. It will be food for you and for them, meaning the animals. And Noah did according to all that God commanded him. So he did it all. Of course, he doesn't mention fish, which makes perfect sense. They don't need to come into the ark. So when it says all creatures, it means all breathing creatures. And I still think it's kind of interesting. You know, God could have just, I'll wipe them out and I'll create new ones. You know, he created them in the first place. But for some reason, you know, he wanted to preserve that creation as a unique event in history. So rather than creating all new ones, he would start, you know, he would preserve the ones that are there. You might want to make I'll put a reference here in your notes. In 1 Peter 3, verses 20 and 21, 1 Peter 3, 20 and 21, in writing his first general epistle, Peter makes a comparison of what's going to happen here to baptism. He says it was a type of baptism. In that sense, where sinfulness is left behind symbolically in the water. You know, for us, when we go into the water, you know, we're putting away our old life, our sins are left behind, and we start a new life. It seems that the world and mankind, you know, was going to do this through the flood. All the old ways are going to be left behind, and God would start over. Okay, sorry, I haven't been looking at my notes. We might wonder, how are you going to get all these animals in there? You know, have you been to a zoo lately? They need a lot of space. Some of them are big. Some answers to that. For one thing, most land creatures are what? That's a very difficult question to answer because there's a lot of ways you could. Julia? Herbivores. True. That's not what I was going for. Most land creatures are insects when you go by just numbers of types. And the majority of creatures are relatively small. Okay, so if you get two of every kind, and we're going to address the fact that it's not just two of every kind, you're going to get 14 of some kinds, but most of these aren't that big. You know, they're not all elephants and hippopotamus. You got ants and wasps and, you know, mice. And it also says of all kinds. It doesn't say of all species. Now, I don't know if the word species existed back then, but... You know, and those who put the ark together go out of their way to make this point. Kinds, if we use our current taxonomic scale, is that the right word, Emily? Taxonomic? Okay, I'm thinking, what's above species? Is that genus? Say, I was thinking in my head, when did I take biology? The last time was in 1980 in biology class. But I remember it's what, kingdom, phyla, and then it gets a little vague, but... all the way down to species. It wasn't necessarily one of each kind of species. So it could have been higher order, and then they were able to differentiate. The point I'm making is the ark could have held them all. Especially if, you know, if I got to bring two hippos, male and a female, do I have to bring two big adult hippos, or can I get a couple infants? Maybe, it's speculation. Now, on the ark, if you visit there, they'll presume that he also took dinosaurs on. Which... you know, I can't disprove it. Part of my thought is, well, if the dinosaurs, why would God have him preserve the dinosaurs, then let them go extinct in an ice age? Why not just leave them outside the ark? But I've brought up a lot of questions that we don't have answers to in Genesis, so let's just leave it at that. All the ones that are preserved are preserved. Of course, the unicorns got left out, right? There's a song about that somewhere. Again, my bottom line point is it doesn't defy science or are just common sense to think that this could have happened. And that's one of the great things about having a reproduction of the ark. When you first go in the entrance, they show how it could have been done with hand tools, the way the Amish build barns today with wooden pegs and all this. And the beams are tree trunks inside there. And you think, okay, this could have happened. Well, of course it could have happened. It did happen. It's in the Bible. It's true. But it's not beyond belief. It didn't require bunches of miracles. Now, it probably did some. I can go a minute or two after, or go longer. Chapter 7. The Lord said to Noah, "Come into the ark, you and your household, because I've seen that you're righteous before me in this generation." Once again, Noah, perfect in his generations, righteous in this generation. Seems to be referring to him standing out in his time period. "Take with you seven each of every clean animal, a male and a female, two each of the animals that are unclean. Also seven each of the birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive." So unlike all the children's book and the little figurines where there's two of each, we find out, oh, there's more of animals that are clean. Clean seems to indicate... or be referring to the restrictions that will be revealed to Israel later in Leviticus 11, referring to which animals you can eat and which ones you can't. And I say revealed because I don't think that it was made up then. And I don't think it was unknown then. Noah doesn't, there's no record of him saying, "Well, God, what in the world do you mean by clean and unclean? Does that refer to the ones that have had a bath or not?" I think the differentiation is something that God made known. And of clean animals, we believe it's seven pairs. The Hebrew here is seven and seven, a male and a female. Because in the English translation, it leaves it vague. Is it seven or is it 14? But the Hebrew seems to indicate it's 14. Seven male, seven female of the clean. Something else before I leave this behind and we take a break. It's, remember, I speculated earlier, or I mentioned that some speculate that before this, everyone was vegetarian. And it's not a groundless speculation, but the distinction of clean and unclean already being known makes you think, well, that seems to pertain to what you can eat. And so that supports the idea that they were not vegetarian. And I'm saying support because there's still room for arguing. Yeah. Almost certainly, you know, all these animals are going to come in. Have you ever tried? I'm reminded of a story at camp in Scotland once. We used to sheep field. Before we got there, the farmer would clear the sheep out. But once when we were there set up, some sheep managed to get through a hole in the fence and were on our area and we had to get them out. It is hard to get a sheep to go where you want it to. That's why shepherds lead instead of herding from behind. But think of all these animals. How does Noah get them there? I think there probably was a miracle, especially the tigers and the condors and all these wild animals. It's likely that God worked with them and brought them to Noah and perhaps induced them to be far more docile than they were before. Charlie had a comment.
Well, you see that even with the birds. Mm. They migrate. God could have just instilled a migrating system at that moment. And they just followed.
Yeah, and there's some speculation that God brought them in and had all of the ones that could hibernate. Because otherwise, you know, without cable TV, they're going to get really bored and they might want to start hunting and eating each other. Still, speculation, we don't know. He brought food of all that's eaten, so big stockpiles of food for the animals and for the people. And again, I believe there were miracles, but I believe it was also God making Noah and the kids and the wives do their part as well. So let's take a break.